Well, I should now be joined by Jimmy Hagen on the other end of the line. Can you hear me all right, Jimmy?
Hello, Duck.
Oh, that's better. I swear I did press that green button this time and it unpressed itself. One of these days I will get the hang of this broadcaster. We're only 3.5 years in. I know you Thanks very much for coming on and joining us. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. We chat a bit offline, but it's really great to have you on the Dr. Rock Show. You're very welcome, sir.
Thanks very much for the invite. It was a bit of a surprise, really. Second time this year on the Dr. Rock Show.
Yeah, it's really great. The quality of the quality's improving all the time, I reckon. We've had some really good guests, and it's great to have you back for a second visit, because you were on the New Year show with us, weren't you?
That's right, and that was a bit of fun. That was, really enjoyed that.
Yep, my first opportunity to run several Skype guests at the same time. It seemed to cope with it pretty well, which reminds me that anybody who wants to call into the show is always welcome on dr.rock2012 on Skype. That's about as far as it goes for means of contacting me, but I'd be really glad to hear from any of you. But Jimmy, I was hoping on kind of, I've listened to the two great shows you did, the Scotland is Free one and the one with John McCann about your recent experiences, and I was hoping to revisit some of them tonight and think about how it might have been different, see if we can't dredge up the stuff that we've heard on MSI and TNS over the years and see how different you might be played next time.
Cool, yeah, let's go there.
I mean, I know the first thing to remember is that everything goes right out of your head from the moment you're under pressure, but I figure that the more often we hear this stuff, the better. I know Synchro got pulled over in not her own van and kind of earlier this year. And it's even quite hard to not give the name, it appears. You know, we're so conditioned to just behave in certain ways, aren't we?
Indeed. Yeah, I guess that's what they say is true, that because we're taught how to give the name just automatically from when we're little children, when we go to school, I guess become ingrained. It's just a natural thing to do.
And yes, this is quite a shocking journey of discovery, I think, for all of us, but to realise that right from all that time ago, the most important thing for us not to give away, we were trained to give away really at the drop of the hat and to anybody who asks.
Yeah, well, I wonder though, sometimes though, do we get too hung up though on the name?
I think that's an important point, isn't it? And you were saying, I know, that you're kind of happy using the name under most circumstances. It's just there's particular places where it's a bit dodgy, isn't it? So who wouldn't you use it for?
Well, you know, sometimes that name might need to operate in commerce and sometimes it doesn't, you know, and I guess the most important thing is just when speaking with uniforms and the like, or anybody that wants to sort of coerce you into going to join there with them, I guess I'd tend to be more careful in a situation like that. Whereas if it was things like, say, if I needed to get some benefits sorted out so things can get sorted in the commercial world for bits and pieces that may need to be done, I don't have any difficulty using the name.
No, I think I've heard it said that you can really put it on a bit like a cloak. You know, you can put it on and take it off.
Well, you know, these are little things I think we still have to work out, really. Like, it's there, like, apparently it's a gift, you know, apparently it's for our benefits, so why shouldn't we have the ability to use it and not use it when we so choose and so wish to. It is a fiction, obviously. We never agreed being that name. I recall much contact anyway. Myself personally, I know if I asked my mum, she'd probably say something different. I'm trying not to get too hung up on the name because, in a sense, in this world, there are times when it's essential that you might have to use it, you know?
I think that's exactly correct, because basically the current construct works by ensuring that our only way of effectively accessing what might be called benefits or might be called our birthright, there's several different ways of looking at it, but services generally, shall we say, and again, I use the word services advisedly, if we actually want to access any of those things, then really our straw party is the portal through which we're being forced to do that, isn't it?
Well, forced is even, I'm not even sure forced is even a correct term. It just seems to be an unfortunate circumstance of the world we live in that, we're corridored into, I guess, this system which, most people, have no choice but to use because, there is a lack of an alternative path really, for most people really. We, in a sense, like, you know, we need housing, we need food, we need benefits these days because there are no alternatives sometimes, especially if we live in cities and the like where access to places for growing food and things like that are not so readily available. It's an unnecessary evil, I think, these days, you know, so... It's just my way of looking at it, I guess.
Yes, yeah, indeed. And I guess we do have one of our more important and more simple solutions under these circumstances is the special use of the BY colon in the signature, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed. I'm just learning myself how to use the BY colon, like, you know, but it just seems that I use it all the time now whenever signing for anything. It's not always going to save your butt, I don't think, but still, if it's true what they say and it nullifies, their ability to cash in, say, on a signature that you may use, I'm all for using it.
Yes, yes, I think that's true. And there's also the aspect of, effectively, I remember Pat saying to you on one of his podcasts that effectively what we're doing when we use the BY colon is that we're signing as a sort of living entity for the name. So we are actually in a way stepping into our power just by doing that.
Well, I guess we are. Yeah. I guess we are because I guess they don't like it like when you sign by colon as we learned like with the Johnny Mead pod there, like, you know, and what an adventure he had that day when when they wouldn't accept his BY colon.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Yeah, I thought that was another real, that was cracking PIR MSI pod. That was it was so real and all for, you know, I mean, it's, I found it, the thing I found most strange about it was that these people had witnessed him signing his signature not once, not twice, but three times. And was still trying to claim that it wasn't his signature. I mean, that's just madness. No wonder he found it a bit confusing.
Indeed, indeed. And you see, I think a lot of the time these folk don't know really that each signature is unique, and basically, no two signatures are alike. There's no way, and especially with the new systems that they have for. Conveying a security instrument such as the signature. They've got that, like, that pen with the little digital, or I don't know what you call it, the little pad that you sign on. I find them impossible to use, you know, and my signatures come out all sorts of crazy ways.
Yes, well, I mean, there's got to be some question, hasn't there, as to whether that's really a signature, given what we know about our blue pens and living entities writing things and stuff like that, whether that digital interface is, in fact, a signature in the real sense of the word has got to be open to question.
Well, it's done by your hand. It's stored digitally, like, you know. So my guess is that it can be conveyed. You know, they're using it. It's acceptable for them. So obviously, like that signature is a commodity to them.
Well, yeah. I guess that's absolutely a fair point. Like everything else is a commodity, it would appear.
Indeed. Well, they need that. Like, you know, if they didn't get those signatures, like, there'd be, like, all the people in the social welfare offices wouldn't have a job to go to. So,
it is an amazing thing, though, because I remember when computers were invented and first started coming about, and when the government started building quite big, computer systems, And they promised us quite specifically that they would never unify all of these systems, and that's exactly what's going on. Right away down to a signature now, where something so subtle and unique can actually find its way into the digital incubus and be usable.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a sign of the times, really. You know, while I don't like it myself personally, because like the way I see digital data and stuff, it's not very, very permanent at all. Like, you know, nothing. So, I don't think it's a great thing to base a society on, like, the movement of you know.
Yeah. Yes, I must admit, I was a bit concerned when we went to get the little piece of paper for the front of the van this year, and there was no little piece of paper anymore. They're saying, oh, it's okay, we know you paid for it, so you no longer have to have it in your window. And I'm thinking, this means I've now got to trust you lot to imagine this thing into existence for me, and trust that I'm not going to get hauled over for, because the offence used to be failure to display, if I remember, and now they're not giving you one to display.
Okay, well, it's displayed on a computer somewhere. Because I do know they've got some quite flashy technology for reading license plates and the like. So, you know, and I think they can even read from the far side of the road as well, too. So they can scan everybody quite quickly these days. And so we just have to trust that the computers don't make any mistakes, I guess.
Yeah, indeed. And, of course, it's a well-known fact that computers are utterly reliable and make no mistakes.
Well, computers don't make mistakes, but the people who use them do, so.
Yeah, and of course, you're only as good as your last backup.
Well, indeed, but I'm sure the governments don't have a problem with backup, you know. I'm sure they have the recommendation hanging straight in front of them, like, you know, data is not data unless it's stored in five different places.
Yes.
If it doesn't exist in five different places, data doesn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah, five different places, that sounds good to me. So,
yeah.
So you've clearly been paying attention to this stuff for a fair while, just because it was TNS that you first stumbled across, but you described yourself before the process of awakening started as a mindless automaton, which I thought was a really great description. What was it like then? I bet you'd rather be what you are now, wouldn't you?
Well, I didn't want to believe it at first, Doc, you know, it was just, you know, that bloody hell, it can't be, you know, it took me for the longest while, really, to even get my head around the fact that, like, I wasn't a name. I just couldn't believe, that was so mind-bending to me, you know, it took me a couple of years just to absorb that, even.
Yes, yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and really, I don't think that feeling for me ever seems to go away. I seem to find other stuff more or less by the day that leaves my brain just floored, just looking at thinking, how can that possibly be the case? And I guess to start with, I started looking into it because I was expecting to find that it wasn't true, that everything was 180 degrees. But of course, the harder you look, the more real it becomes, doesn't it?
Well, it's right in your face, really, you know, especially when you find yourself on the path of looking at, like, what exactly is involved in being game, you know, and it's just, after it does sink in, like, it does, it says, it's so true. You can't be game, you know, you just can't be possible.
Yeah, I guess then at that stage, I felt that it became necessary to start acting in some way, whichever way I could, on the knowledge that was coming my way. In that, once your incredulous mind has kind of started really taking this stuff on board, it no longer seems possible to really play the game the way you were playing it before. Was it like that for you?
Oh, it's impossible to go back, Doc. You know, impossible.
Mm.
I couldn't go back anyway. Not now. You know, just I'd find it impossible.
Yes, I think it's one of those things that strikes me as strange, in that the behaviour of those of us who have realised that we've walked through the looking glass and are living in a world that is utterly and wholly different from the world we were brought up in, to us it's necessary action. To other people who are not in that position, it's completely crazy, which is a really interesting situation to find yourself in.
It is for sure. It is for sure. And there's no convincing other people. All you gotta do, you can't really worry about everybody else. Like, you just gotta trust your gut, I guess. You know, if it sounds true, if it rings true, then it must be true, you know.
And at least to a certain extent, I suppose, nowadays, we do find a bit of support arising around us when we choose to step out of line. Might not have been the case kind of 10 years ago, but there seem to be more people who are waking up to look at what you're doing and realise there might be a reason for you doing it.
Oh, just mass awakening. I often have to wonder if any such thing as a mass awakening, you know, and is it possible that, like, the amount of people that's awake today is the same amount of people that was awake 100, 200 years ago.
Yeah, I guess we've always had, we've had people like the Luddites and the Muggletonians and the Chartists and people who seem to be on the edge of realizing what it is that's going on around them. But, I do feel that what we're perhaps seeing for the first time here is not only kind of increased numbers of people realizing what's going on, partly because what's going on is so outrageous, but what we're now seeing is groups of people, you know, networks, network hubs meeting each other so that groups of people are meeting other groups of people. I think there's a lot of potential for changing behavior if people respond the way we've done, which is once you find out you feel you must act, that to not act is not an option. Aha, sounds like I might have just lost Jimmy there. Is that, what's going on here?
Hey, buddy.
Hey there, that was you. Very, very good.
I think the Skype's playing up a bit this evening as well, so,
Yeah, Skype always does it, in my experience. Sometimes it's reliable, but, actually I think we've got a slightly clearer line on it now. Anyway, I can hear you a bit better. You were a bit crackly before. Just trying to...
Okay. Where did we leave off? We were chatting about the awakening, weren't we? This yes. Global awakening.
Yeah.
And then
yes.
We cut off around there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously...
You were explaining about Luddites. Would you care to expand on?
I was suggesting that there have been lots of groups in the past, like Luddites and Chartists and Muggletonians and various other people who've realised, I guess, this kind of feeling that something is not quite right and have tried to act on it. It just seems to me that now we've got the internet and we've also got networks of people meeting to spread information. But I think our biggest advantage, if such it could be called, is that the activities that make us want to change are becoming ever more blatant and ever more noticeable daily. So hopefully there'll be more people wanting to join in.
Well, I think what's happening now is it's a necessary process, I think, because we're living in a collapsing society with a collapsing economy and stuff, and people are desperate for some sort of way out, I think, and I think people are starting to realize there's got to be more to the drudgery of life than just paying these bloody bills and just always struggling to keep the head above water.
Yes, yes, indeed, because I can remember what life was like before I noticed that any of that was going on and before I actually had to pay for any of it either, you know, as a youngster. And it is amazing how it's changed and continues to change. But what it seems to me that one of the biggest lenses into our lives, into our everyday lives, are via our machines, via the things that we use to get around the place. Cause it seems that we're most easily watched and logged when we're moving around like that. And also it's when we're most vulnerable, because for some reason people seem to think it's necessary for us to carry some sort of ID when we're driving it. Whereas when we're just walking around, I guess there's not such heavy expectations placed upon us. And I gather from,
I wish I could be with that there, but I was just not there in the States in the last couple of days. Some man was arrested by the police for walking without a license.
Was he really? Where did you hear that from?
That came through on the news services over there in the States. Walking without a license, isn't that amazing?
Oh wow, that's incredible, really. I think that in the States you're kind of expected to carry some sort of ID entity on you, even when you're walking down the pavement, but over here in, you know, in United Kingdom PLC, I don't think we're obliged to carry any identity papers normally, are we?
Well, I know out on the continent, it was a requirement for people to have their ID cards with them. It was probably something got to do with the legacy from the war, probably.
Yeah. Although I guess if people made the arguments, I know, I gather, because I've often wondered whether it's the same in Europe as, you know, say somewhere like France and Spain as it is here, where you can actually question these things and get away with it. But listening to Patty's saying, I guess quite correctly, that it is true everywhere that the actual power lies with the individual and that the need to carry identity papers is kind of illusory. But it's sort of illusory in the car as well, isn't it? Because when they stop you and knock, or in the machine, when they stop and knock on your window and ask to see a license, they're kind of after ID rather than a license as such, aren't they? They're sort of trying to pull the wool over your eyes.
I think it's probably something got to do with their training as well, too. They're trained to the ID, basically, and you see, they believe it. And they expect that everybody else believes it because they believe it.
Yes. But at the same time, it's strange, isn't it, under those circumstances that you can do what you did and write, what was it, your name and date of birth on a piece of paper and show that to them. And that is actually all they need, although they're asking you for a license.
Exactly.
Yeah, carry on.
Yeah, well, this is it, you know, and well, it didn't work the last time, you know. 9 times out of 10, you'll be on your way and walking through, they'll accept it, like, you know, but it just didn't, they didn't accept it off me that time.
Yes, yeah, and I guess it's partly because it sounded like you'd had quite a lot of chatting with them, which is, well, I think I'd feel tempted to do as well, And you were actually, you ran into a place where you just had to stop, didn't you? It wasn't a matter of a single machine behind you trying to get you to pull over. You
came. Yeah, it was a military checkpoint.
I was struck by the fact that,
No, it was...
Sorry, carry on.
No, you're all right.
I was struck, you said that there weren't any numbers visible on any of the people that stopped you. Was that true of all of them or just the one you were talking to?
No, there was none at all. That appeared to be true with a whole lot of them. Like, they had their jackets, they probably had numbers on underneath, like, you know, but, you know, I was, when he was at the window and I was looking for identification on, like, on his person, like, you know, so I asked him to identify himself and he refused to identify himself.
I wonder if that's, I found myself thinking about that and, because that wouldn't have been the case, I think, a few years ago when you asked an apparent officer his name. He would give it to you. I was wondering whether that was because of the work we're doing, making it apparent that you need to be careful of your name, or whether they're becoming aware that by giving their name they're taking on some sort of liability. What do you reckon?
I'm not sure, no. I think he was just being awkward, this dude, personally. You know, I guess he was just trying to play the same game as me, I guess. You know, he was playing the name game after a couple of minutes himself, you know, and he was doing the contemporaneous notes game himself too after a couple of minutes, and he was getting quite into the groove of it.
Yeah, indeed. Well, how did your contemporaneous notes work? I meant to ask you that. Were you writing down everything that happened or just little bits and pieces?
I was only writing down just little bits and pieces of important, what I thought was important at the time, such as if I asked a question, I wrote down asked the officer to identify himself and he refused to identify himself. So I wrote down, officer refused to identify.
And is that one of the things that you think you'd do differently in future? Do you think you'd try and write down everything that occurred?
I would. I'd write down everything. Everything. I'd write down everything that I observed, everything that I heard. I didn't write down half enough, like, on the day.
I guess it's difficult to tell what's going to be important, isn't it?
Well, this is it. In fact, the way I look at it is it's all important because what I noticed this time in court was when the guard was being questioned and he had all his contemporaneous notes from on the day and he actually read the whole thing out and there were several pages of it. And, you know, and I was a little embarrassed as well, too, because I could have several pages, too, you know, and he had a couple of sentences. So, you know, so if, you know, if I'm thinking what I'm going to do the next time would be, I'd write a book, basically. I'd write a book, and then when it was time for me to speak in court, and then I'd introduce my contemporaneous notes of the occasion. So,
I guess that as well as giving you something to actually put into the court, it might also occurs to me have the advantage of kind of slowing the whole thing down a bit, giving you time to think about what you're going to do next.
I'm not sure it would have slowed much down. Like, you know, as I said, the court has its own way of working, really, you know, and it carries on at its own pace regardless. Like, so, but yeah, definitely getting my story into the court next time would be, very, very high on the agenda, and having it quite detailed, extremely detailed, I'd say.
Yeah, I was thinking more about slowing it down actually on the side of the road. If you're writing down everything he says and everything you say, then suddenly the whole thing's not running at quite the pace it might do.
Oh, that's an interesting point, Doc. Yeah, indeed, that definitely would slow things down a hell of a lot more on the side of the road.
Because another thing that struck me as a bit unusual about yours was that you found yourself with only a single one concentrating on you by your window, and quite often they work in twos or threes, which would make it a little bit more difficult to write down everything that happened. But it would have been interesting to see how that would have worked in your situation.
Yeah, indeed, it was. I did find it interesting, actually, that it was just himself, like, and every time he gets stuck, he was running off over this lady who was also there. She was obviously doing other things, they were just out of earshot range. But like he'd get stuck and he'd go and chat with her for a few minutes, and then he'd come back and he'd try again. So it was quite comical, really. Yeah.
I guess the other thing about if you've got kind of full notes or full notes under recording, I always carry a voice recorder around me, and I gather that most mobile phones will make a recording, would also allow you to go back over it in some detail, wouldn't it, to find out what you might do better or where you really scored. You could then look back at it in the cold light of day, which I guess would be really helpful, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, I have been thinking about a decent recorder would be good, something that done video and voice, I think would be very, very useful, and something discreet that you could have on your person, say, like, you know, especially with all this new tech that's coming out, that you can have embedded tech on your clothes and stuff like that, so you could have a little tiny camera. I think that would be really, really useful.
Yes, I think possibly even two cameras, one that's, as you say, kind of embedded in your clothes, and one that you let them know that you're filming with, because it does seem to me that any attempts to limit accountability, shall we say, tend to be somewhat limited when people start filming you.
Well, you see, this is it, you know, and like video is also admissible in the court, like, you know, so like if the cameras are on them, they'll be under pressure then to do it correctly.
Yeah, yes, which might not be the case otherwise. SD's put in the chat box, he's put, did your man identify himself as an officer, Jimmy?
Did he identify himself as an officer? He didn't want to identify himself at all at first, but I think eventually he did identify himself as Garda.
Which I guess...
Garda is such and such.
Yeah, so did you accept and acknowledge his oath of office?
Well, at first, like, yeah, actually, this was a good point. While all the drama was going on, like, and, you know, I made it quite clear that I didn't recognize him or I didn't understand him, like, you know, and he wasn't really happy about that, like, but I think after he'd been backwards and forwards a couple of times to this female who was giving him, coaching him, you know, he was trying to get, I did say to him, he says, I'll accept and acknowledge of your oath of office. You know, he says, so you'll accept it, you'll accept my oath of office. So, yeah, I did put that in, yeah.
I think that's quite an important distinction, isn't it, to recognise the oath of office whilst not recognising the officer is a fine and important line to be drawing.
Yeah, indeed, you know, because... He was telling me how he was going to be arrested, this, that, and the other. And he says, "Oh, you probably won't even recognise the court."
Well, he's right there, I guess.
Yeah, well, that was just, he said that just before I said to him, "I'll accept and acknowledge of your oath of office." And, well, just previous to that, he said, "You probably won't recognize the court," you know, so, so that's how I eventually, I did say that I'll accept and acknowledge of your oath of office.
Yeah. And this is all just for a kind of routine stop, isn't it, really? It's amazing how quickly things can kind of unravel themselves, was what I was thinking, was you just drive round a corner and find this thing visited upon you. And I guess one of the ways that we seem to get imposed on in these circumstances is there's a guy standing above you, tapping on your window and asking you a series of questions. And it's always struck me that, listening to other people's experience, people like Soft T and, you know, the rest of them, is that having a whole load of questions to ask back really kind of can diffuse the pressure a little bit. Did you manage to get many questions in before having to kind of write down whatever it was that you wrote and showed him? Or did that happen quite quickly?
Oh, that straight away I just wrote down, you know. It says, like, when I travel around the roads, you know, it's my intention that I'm not going to be speaking to them, or if I have to speak, it'll be as little as very, very little as possible. So, as soon as he was looking for the ID, I wrote it down for him, showed it to him, and said, "Is that what you're looking for?" And, I just stuck to that. And mm-hmm. that was basically all I said, like, you know.
Yeah. And is that what you're looking for is important, isn't it? Because you don't want to be, acting on the presumption that that's what they're looking for, because that can cede them what they want.
Indeed, you know, and, when I said to him, "Is that what you're looking for?" And he says, he'd turn around to me and he'd say, "How would I know? How do I know that that's you?"
But he's got you in front of him, isn't he? That's the important thing, really.
I believe everything you need to know is right there.
And then excuse me, I've got a bit of a cough tonight and I can't mute my mic without muting you as well. Yeah, and I guess that's it really, isn't it? That's what you try and stick with, and they kept you there for a whole hour. Hour and 20 minutes. What was running through your mind whilst you, what came to you whilst you were sitting there for all that time?
In what sense now, Doc?
Well, you'd accepted and acknowledged his oath of office, said that you didn't recognise him, let him know who you were without actually speaking it.
I didn't exactly accept his oath of office. What I says to him was, I'll accept and acknowledge of your oath of office.
Yeah.
I'll accept his acknowledgement of his oath of office, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I'm not saying that I'm accept.
Yeah, indeed. What was it? What did you actually write down? The name and date of birth, or do they want an address? I'm just wondering what they're after there.
Well, ID, I guess, name, address, DOB, maybe a telephone number if they'd like, you know, because I have seen before, they might ask for a telephone number, and you could write the telephone number down, and that's usually all they really require. You could be traveling out in the continent as well too, and all they need is a name and a date of birth to identify somebody.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's pretty much what I would have thought.
It is. Yeah.
It is very strange that, why do you suppose it is that it's so important that we speak it? Because we've heard that emphasised again and again, that when people write it down, there's a lot of effort made to get you to actually voice the words that are on the paper. Why do you suppose that is?
They need you to give it, they need you to give evidence against yourself, basically.
And I guess by speaking it proves that we've got breath, I guess, and that we're alive.
Exactly. Like, you know, as long as you're writing it down and you're yourself, basically.
Yeah. I remember hearing once that if you can get the name and number of the Garda or policeman concerned, then any documents that come to you can be sent back to him in person. Is that right, do you think? Have you heard that?
I'm not sure, but I'd love to find out all these little nuances of how to operate within the fiction, you know, which all that still eludes me, really, of how this paperwork is really supposed to work, you know. And I just don't get that end of it. Like, you know, I'm just, I suppose you could say I'm on the bottom rung of the ladder here trying to piece it together in my own mind, and
I think
and that's where I am.
Yeah, I think you're on the rung. You're on the rung above me, then. You definitely got... But what, this is one of the things that I really enjoyed about listening to your shows with John McSee and with Pat, was that listening to you talking about the actual experience was reminding me of all of the things that I've heard in the years I've been listening to these radio stations. And that's what I'm, I guess what I'm exploring here is the things that came back to me whilst I was listening to you. And I was thinking, it's such a shame, because we have actually, as a result of MSI disappearing and TNS, we appear to have lost quite a lot of the useful pods. So I'm just relying on memory, really. I guess it'd be worth experimenting with trying to get their number off them. Because did you get given papers at the side of the road as a result of all of this, or does that go into suspension once they decide to break your window, arrest you, and drag you down the cop shop?
Yeah, well, you see, I don't think you get a ticket as such. Like, I think I probably could have got a ticket there if I played it correctly. Like, but I think if you notice from listening to the pods, I did screw up at one point. You know, when he asked where I'd like to produce, say, the documentation. You know, and I didn't write down the name of the station. So, I guess if I had written down the name of the station right there, I could have probably had a ticket or something like that, and I could have, you know, things could have worked out a lot differently.
Yes, yeah, just one small slip, I guess that's all it takes. And I guess they are, by voicing something, you are the living soul engaging with them, following an order, really. Was that basically what it boiled down to?
Following an order. What exactly are you asking?
Oh, no, I suppose he when he asked you which station you wanted to return, you wanted to show your documents at, basically responding with the voice, that's what did for you.
I think so, yeah. Even though it was a question, it wasn't a good one.
Yeah.
You know, I just took my head, but I did, I took my eye off the ball for a bit second, so instead of writing it down, I opened my bloody trap.
And I guess really what we're playing here is, it always reminds me of that old yes no game that I don't know whether you ever played it, where somebody has the job of asking a load of questions and your job as the respondee is not to answer yes or no.
Yeah, that's Gunderson. What's that film?
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Is that what you mean?
I remember somebody's been playing a pod of verbal tennis, really. But yes, just like that.
Verbal tennis.
Yeah. where you're basically not agreeing and you're not disagreeing. Because I remember hearing that to disagree is to raise dispute and to hold liability, and so need to supply remedy, which is basically what you're trying to avoid, isn't it?
Well, indeed, yeah. You don't want to be disagreeing either, you know. But at the same time, you don't want to be agreeing. Yeah, I suppose you want to be conditionally accepting, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. So asking questions is one of the safest things we can do. I seem to remember, once again, something that's kind of in the dim and distant past for me. I seem to remember hearing a YouTube clip from America, like I say, a few years back, not sure it had worked now, where he appeared to get away with just saying, "I do not recognise you, I do not understand you," and eventually was allowed to go.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. Yes,
that sounds like the basics of the return to sender.
Yes, which I guess, you know, is kind of what you're doing, isn't it? They're, in a sense, trying to get you into contract, which is what people are doing when they reportedly send you these letters through the door. And you're trying to try not to get into a contract, which is effectively kind of trying to do the return to sender, but doing it kind of by words, using it at the side of the road.
Indeed. I've seen another one there quite recently too, also from the States, and instead of like at these checkpoints for DUI checkpoints, and instead of winding down the window, these dudes had their paperwork attached to a string, and they just pop it out the window and keep their window closed, and then they drive up at the checkpoint. The police officers said they see that they see the documents there, and they can see the licenses and this, that, and the other, like, because a lot of people can be arrested, like, and all the officers got to do is says, oh, we smelt alcohol, you know, and when your windows are totally up, they can't use that. They can't say they smelled alcohol when your windows are totally up. Like, so all you got to do is just show them the documents and you're on your way.
Right. Yes. So, no room for speaking at all. Dot's put in the chat box. Was Jimmy.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Was Jimmy solely relying on writing for communication with the guard? And, I think that was your aim in principle, wasn't it?
Well, the aim in principle was just not convey the security instruments. Not just didn't want to go into joiner with the name, basically, and that didn't mean that I wasn't going to totally not converse with them, like, you know. But because I like to keep things kind of light and humorous on the side of the road too, you know. But keep it real, like, you know. And if there's a question to ask, like, say, ask the question, you know. It says, who's asking that? Get the operator in question to identify himself, and you know, there's no harm asking those questions, I believe, you know.
Yes, indeed. SD's put in the chat box, who are you? A guardee. He says, I acknowledge and accept your oath of office and hold you to that office by the power of God under God, so help me God, for now we have a binding contract. I've always been a bit worried about the now we have a binding contract bit, because I'm not quite sure how that's occurring. Have you ever understood that?
Not really. I've heard that used a lot, really, in a lot of places, like, you know, from people saying they've used it in courts, and people use it on the side of the roads, but I haven't seen it. I've no first-hand knowledge of it being used. I haven't seen it been used, so I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, all I know is what I use, which is what I try to keep simple, and I just, if I need to convey identity or something like that, I just write it down and I just keep it there, because I don't know enough to be messing around with stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I must admit, although I haven't had any experience with policemen and traffic stops, my experience has been solely with third-party interlopers known as bailiffs, who haven't had anything to do with me at all, and just talking to them seems to have caused a whole lot of grief, so... Well, I think my instinct in future would be probably not to talk at all. I remember Nick Nomick actually referring on a show he did on the John McSee show to a YouTube video called Never Talk to the Police Under Any Circumstances. That American lawyer who gives you 10 good reasons why you shouldn't. And the first reason is that it couldn't possibly help. So my instinct now, and not only with them, but with, there's lots of county council snoopers and stuff wandering around the place asking people impertinent questions. My instinct would be, I think now, to deal only with them in writing. Do you think you'd still feel, the need to try and keep it light and engage with them, you know, any more than is, say, absolutely necessary?
Just only as much as is necessary, really, like... as I say, look, I think everybody's situation is different. From incidents that I know have happened, like you can say sometimes be visited by an officer, say, from your locality, and you may already have a little bit of a rapport with them. So, like, in a situation like that, that's going to be quite different, you know, and it may be safe enough to converse lightly in such situations, you know. As I say, like, each situation is going to be different.
Yes, I agree. I think that certainly around here they like to keep policing apparently pretty informal, so these characters do get to chat. And in fact, we do, you know, everybody chats on the streets in New Radnor, you know, when you go shopping, and it's just part of the everyday thing. So I guess you're saying never say never on that one.
Yeah, you know, like, because Not all police are bad. They're not all, you know, bad guys as such, you know. You are going to get sometimes into situations like, especially with officers that you don't know. I think they could be flashpoints, you know. So be careful if you don't know an officer, but if you know them, I think, and you have a good relationship with them, I think it may be safe just to converse lightly, you know, without giving too much away.
Yes, yeah, I tend to agree. I guess basically it's sort of common humanity, because you are dealing with a man underneath the uniform, aren't you? And I guess it's always worth trying to communicate with them, quite apart from anything else.
Indeed, what you have to say just reminds me of the Daleks, you know. You got the man inside in the machine, you know, somewhere deep down there.
Yeah, Laurie's put into the chat box, learn from them, you have the right to remain silent. They are telling you to shut the fuck up. And actually, I must admit, Laurie is one of the main influences that has kind of herded me towards not saying a word as far as possible, because I remember having conversations with her and saying, well, what about this? And she's just going, no, don't say anything. But again, I think there are situations when it's slightly more social and less business, shall we say, and you have to think for yourself then, don't you?
Well, indeed. I know of one case where a friend knew a local sergeant who had come on formal business, like, and he kept it light. And in general, I think in situations like that, the local man probably won't go near you, but what will happen is he'll probably ring to another area where there'd be police that wouldn't know you, and they're quite likely to send them to do the dirty work, you know?
I think that apart from the PCSOs around here, we quite often get police from other towns here, and the police that are stationed here go elsewhere. My mind just slipped off the... I guess that the time that really changes is from the point at which you're arrested once they lay hands on you. My understanding is that at that stage, the best thing to do is really say nothing at all. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, absolutely. I see SD asking in there, and it said, did they drag me from the machine? And that's a big yes on that one, SD.
Yeah, broke your window, didn't they? And I guess that...
Did it. Window.
They kind of haven't got any choice, because presumably you've got the doors locked, because you don't want to be, complying in any sense, do you?
Well, that's it, you know, and I'm not feeling lonely, you know, I don't want to, you know, if they're going to have to get in, I'm not going to leave an easy route for them in, like, you know, I'm in my abode, and I don't want anybody breaking into it as such, or just opening the door, just not too easy.
Yes, and you can bet your ass they haven't got a warrant.
No, of course they didn't.
Yeah, so they actually physically manhandled you out of the car, and presumably that you got arrested at that point, did you? And read your rights or whatever?
Indeed, yeah.
And did you at that stage sort of clam up? Because I remember hearing Rob Freeman talking about this. He was one of the... Because there's a bit of a... This is why I really enjoyed hearing your podcast, is because for quite a while, there was kind of a bit of a wall between what happened when you were arrested and what actually happened to you in a police station. And Rob Freeman was the first man I heard talking about this. And I remember him saying that he tried really hard not to be there anymore, to imagine himself to be invisible, to imagine himself to be deaf, and to imagine himself really to be somewhere else, because even once you're arrested, people are still trying to get subject matter jurisdiction from you, aren't they?
Of course they are, yeah, of course they are. And the game carries on, the police station, and, you know, the way I look at it is you can close your eyes and imagine yourself somewhere else, but when you open them again, you're still there in a situation, so how you're going to deal with it is the main thing.
Yes, yes, indeed. Again, Laurie's put in, if you're asked a question, answer it with a question.
It may be helpful to close.
Maybe helpful to close, sorry.
Yeah, well, they did ask me many questions, but as I say, look, I just stuck. I didn't recognise them, you know, and that's all they got from me. I don't recognise you, and I don't understand you.
Yes, yeah, indeed, fairly safe statements. Those Carrots has put, invest in a dash cam, folks. It can only help at these times. That seems like quite a good idea, doesn't it? uniquely says, well, sorry, carry on, yeah.
Yeah, well, dash cam can be all right, like, but I think I'd go for something more mobile. I think I'd something that I could have on my body because, you know, your dash cam could get left behind. You know? So I think something private, something on the, something that carry on your body and that goes with you. Like, I think it is a must and has its own power source, I guess, and doesn't depend on power from the car.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Unique Lee's put in, is it civil or criminal, should really be the initial reply. Did you try that one at the roadside?
I didn't, no, because there was no need. He just wanted ID. And it was my belief that he had everything he needed to know written right down on a notepad there in front of him. So I didn't feel the need to go into civil or criminal right there. I said, the way I look at it is civil or criminal is a matter for between you and the judge, I guess.
He's the only one that's in a position to make a legal determination, isn't he? I see your point there.
I'm sure, though, the judge is supposed to be impartial and, you know, he's not supposed to be practicing law from the bench, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a judge can't make a legal determination. That's a matter for, I suppose, lawyers and the like and barristers.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough, although I guess the judge is the only one that you want to end up talking to, isn't he, as far as I can gather?
Indeed, indeed.
Laurie's put in a good point there. Invest in a pen and a paper, she says of you. Have you ever heard of someone who is deaf and dumb that has been charged? Now, that's an interesting question, isn't it?
Interesting. That'd be worth looking into.
Yes. Yes, indeed, because they, of course, they can't speak and they'd have to write everything down. It would be very interesting, that, I agree. It's just one of those passing ideas that I thought that's well worth playing with. And you, when they got around to reading charges to you, what charges did you end up kind of being taken to court on? Because presumably, I didn't quite catch this. Did they keep you overnight after this experience?
No. Well, they did. They tried to get me to accept charges, but I wasn't accepting anything off them, you know. He did. He came into the cell just before we went to court, and he had loads and loads of papers, and he was trying to get me to accept these papers as, you know, I'm not accepting or understanding,
mm-hmm.
you know, basically. But what he was doing was he was writing down my responses when certain charges were read, like, you know, I can't remember. I think there was charges relating to, say, not having a license, not having insurance or tax or bits and pieces like that. So as he was reading out the charges, he was looking for my responses. So my response to all of it was, I do not understand you or I do not recognize you.
Yeah. And then, so, there was a kind of stop and then the arrest, and they took you down to the police station and read the charges that you didn't recognise. And when did you go to court? Was that on the same day or the next day, or how did that pan out?
No, that was the same day. That was the same.
I see.
Down to the courtroom.
Straight down there.
Yeah, yeah. Do not pass go.
I'm just sort of momentarily stunned at how quickly that can happen. Because I've heard of people being kept overnight and kept awake all night and then taken to court. But to realise that you can encounter the police, stop, be processed through the police station, and find yourself at court all in the same day is quite stunning, really, when you think about it, isn't it? And they're not even supposed to be able to arrest you unless you've been found guilty by a jury, I thought.
I'm not sure, lad. You know, that's a... You see, that's their game, and I don't know much about their game. You know, it seems to me these days they can arrest you and take you for nonsensical things. It just seems to be the direction it's going. Like, you know, you could end up like being arrested and being took before a judge just on a matter of, say, homeschooling even. So, you know, these are the times we live in, you know. So, you know, it's not, you may not, you may not be sovereign locum around, but you could be just homeschooling or doing something benign like that, and you could end up in front of a judge on the same day. So, nobody's safe.
I can't help feeling that a lot of that activity that you've just described is probably acting outside their office, in that if they were required to document and validate their claims or the obligation being placed on you, they'd find it not possible to do that, but it's all being done on a presumption that we're failing to rebut in some way.
Yeah, that's the way I see it too, because I wasn't operating in court correctly on the day, and I probably should have rebutted a lot of the things which I didn't do, but that's lack of experience, I guess, really. Mm. And, you know, there's a lot of things I'd do differently the next time, you know.
What would be the what would be your major headlines on what you'd do differently in the court next time?
Well, I guess I'd rebut, like, you know. I guess I'd learn how to rebut now. That'll be my next mission, I guess, is to learn how to rebut correctly, like, and at the correct time.
Yes. Yeah, that sounds like it's going to be an interesting field of investigation.
Well, indeed, you know, I know we learn all the time, we shouldn't really be going into court, really, but sometimes you may have no choice and you might just get dragged there anyway, so the way I look at it now these days, I think it's vital that we actually learn about court procedure, I guess, and if there are ways to operate and still stay outside the court, I think all the better. Like, you know, this is what I'm looking at now. So it's going to mean, I guess, having a look at some of this common law stuff, I guess, and maybe picking up bits of interest in that subject, really.
Yes, I guess. Yeah, because you're right. You know, I mean, to a certain extent, the various solutions we've got actually do seem to be uncommonly good at keeping people out of court, but it does seem like you say that you stand more and more chance as time goes by of being dragged in there against your will under the slightest pretext. So some idea of how it works is probably going to prove to be necessary. Where are you going to go to do that research? What do you reckon you're going to be looking at?
Oh, I have no idea, but I'm going to ask a few people that I know have on my contact list, you know, who do know a few bits and pieces about the common law. So I'm just going to be picking their brains, I guess, like, especially when it comes to paperwork and stuff like that, because I know we're always advised to stay away from the paperwork as much as possible, and I do tend to agree with it, like, but there are times, especially when you end up in a situation like I've ended up in, and, you know, you're stuck in the system and you've got really no recourse, you've got no way out, really, so except sort of learn some of their systems and learn some of their procedures, I guess, and
yes. Yeah, my impression is that I've got a growing impression that once you find yourself in your situation, that being able to manage a bit of the paperwork can be hugely advantageous, because, you know, it's a fictional establishment you're entering and the stuff it deals with is a fiction. And it does, there have been several people recently who've suggested that managing the paperwork can actually save you from having to manage the actual experience of being there.
Yeah, well, from some of the stuff I've been discovering lately, it does appear that there may be some remedies in the paperwork. Like, you know, I don't want to talk about it because I don't know very much about it. There may well be remedy there, but again, there may not. Like, time will tell.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'll tell you what, shall I put on some tunes so that we can have a cup of tea or so, and then sort of come back together in sort of 10 minutes or so? Fancy a bit of a break?
Yeah, that break would be cool. Cheers, man. Cheers.
There you go. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show live on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we are seeking solutions tonight with Jimmy Hagan. Thanks for joining us again, Jimmy.
You're so welcome, Doc. Again, thanks for the invite to come on and speak.
No problem. It's proven to be very educational for me. And when we were having a bit of a break there, you were telling me that you've got a new show lined up. Do you want to give it a bit of a punt so people know to come and listen?
Oh, indeed, yeah. Well, we're going to be kicking off this Sunday from 4 till 7. Myself and Sean McGee are starting up the European News Weekly Show. But I guarantee it's going to be more than just European news on that, like, you know, because Sean is a great lad and he's an anti-nuke activist as well, too. So We just completed our first pod there earlier on with Dune, and he'll be coming on giving us some Fukushima updates, and we got a longer pod than usual. That we only planned half an hour, and it must have ended up nearly an hour, so it was very, very interesting. So 4 o'clock till 7, European News Weekly, just before the OIM guys on Sunday. So myself and Sean McGee, so keep an eye out for that.
That sounds really good to me, because as many people will know, I don't keep any sort of eye on the mainstream media at all, and I find it very useful that there are shows on PIR now that are keeping me in touch, and I think the things that you guys choose to listen to and talk about are the things that I need to hear about, so I'm really grateful that you're joining a throng of shows, really, that are doing that kind of work now. I really look forward to it.
Yeah, well, it's kind of needed, like, you know, because the mainstream media are not really covering the news as such. Like, you're getting the propaganda machine sort of like a script that's handed down from, say, the main news agency, and their stories filter down to all the rest of the newspapers and TV stations. So they all regurgitate the same old rubbish over and over and over again. And so, it just becomes a little bit mind numbing at times, and you don't get any real news. So, I guess a decent news service is kind of would be a good addition, really. I'm looking forward to working with Sean, really. Sean's a great guy. He's very, very knowledgeable, and I think I'm going to learn enough from working with him, like, not just about the news, but also about journalism, because he's quite a journalist himself, and so very interesting guy. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, and he's made a fair few contacts in his time out there, hasn't he? So there should be some interesting people to talk to, hopefully, over time, because finding guests is always a bit of a challenge.
Indeed, but I think Sean's not going to have any problems with that.
This is one of the things I mean now, is that the individuals are now so well connected and so know so many other kind of, if you like, key individuals to talk to, that it's making it, to a certain extent, easier to get a wide range of properly informed views, because investigative journalism is not dead in the new media, in my opinion. It's very much alive and kicking ass, in fact.
Well, I tend to agree, really. I mean, you've got, like, the internet has been brilliant, like, bringing groups of people together, like, you know. There's many, many different groups out there. They're all working on different topics and different subjects, like, and in a sense, you know, bloggers is where the news is at these days, and they're doing the real work. Like, so, I guess in a way, a little platform for the bloggers and the activists is not such a bad thing. It can only be a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. And it has to be said, when the days when I did listen to the mainstream media, the shows that I tended to like best were where there were three or four so-called experts lined up to, as they put it, talk around a subject. But once I started awakening to all of this stuff, I realised that I wasn't ever hearing my views or anything approaching the views of the people I was speaking with on these media. So the opportunity not only to put it out as a radio show, but I don't think we can really underestimate the importance of podcasts, so people can come back to it, take it away, play it to other people and talk about it in the privacy of their own dwellings and stuff. I think it's a vital solution-seeking service, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely, because do you know what? I'm a podcast maniac myself. I listen to so much radio and so many podcasts, you know, and I guess I'm not the only one out there. There must be millions of me out there.
Yeah, I get a lot of more use out of my voice recorder and MP3 player with a couple of batteries in it than I do out of the laptop, because, you know, every couple of hours or so, that needs to be took away and recharged. So I'm the same. In fact, I'm downloading so many podcasts now that I'm getting to the point where I need another pair of ears to be able to listen to them all.
Well, just share the stuff, share it, and you have lots of ears.
So I just want to return briefly to your time in the court, because there are a couple of things that I thought were quite significant in there. One is that, in some sense, you'd obviously ceded jurisdiction to end up there in the first place. And for a fair while, I was under the impression that that once that had happened, you were pretty much dead meat right to the end of the line, really. But your asking the judge whether it was civil or criminal did, in fact, get you a result which you weren't in a position to take advantage of. which was a good move, wasn't it?
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Asking the civil or the criminal did make a difference, like, you know, but when he fobbed me off with the criminal, you know, I didn't know enough really to counter it, you know. What you were saying, what you said there was quite ironic, really. From the minute I ended up in the system, like, I was dead meat, and that's correct. I'm still dead meat.
Yeah, but you did hit him with the recommended response, didn't you? Which is, do you have a claim against me? Which was a successful question.
I did, yeah, yeah, and, actually, there was a big question around that, and it only became apparent afterwards, after the show I did with Jay McSee, because myself and Jay McSee were having a chat about the claim business, you know, and we obviously hadn't a clue what the difference between a claim and a complaint. And, so somebody from the chat box got in touch with us, like, you know, and he told us the story and he said he couldn't believe it. Like, these guys, they don't even know the difference between a claim and a complaint. So, so somebody was very, very kind to actually inform us about the difference between complaint and claim. And, I do believe now I have a better understanding of the difference between the two.
And, are you in a position to explain it to us? Yeah.
I'm just going to do that now. Says, only a man or a woman can make a claim. And, police officers and all those councils and all those, they're stuck with making complaints.
Ah. Yeah.
So only a man or a woman can go in and make a claim. And, usually a claim is used in a situation where there's been harm, injury or loss, committed. And you claim in, like, you know, such and such was done to me, and you're looking for remedy in the matter, basically. So that'd be a claim, whereas police and all that lot, they only do complaints.
That is a very useful distinction to be able to make, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
So was your question, do you remember whether your question to the judge was, do you have a complaint or a claim against me?
I remember, do you have a claim against me?
Yeah, and he said no.
And when it, no, and he said, but officer such and such does. So, and in fact, it was pointed out to me that what I should have said was, is there any man or woman here today that has a claim against me showing where I committed harm, injury, or loss? Step forward.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that sounds like a really good lesson to be carrying forward. I remember it was commented on one of the pods that, I can't remember who it was, somebody put into the chat box at that point, I see no injured party. I remember that being, I think one of Mr. T's was, I see no, and then, whatever it is that's relevant. And I remember, Synchro telling me that there used to be a lot of what was called by officialdom poaching. In these regions, not so many years back, I guess we'd probably call it foraging, in fairness. But, apparently a geezer was caught with some salmon in the back of his motor by the, local policeman, and they were a lot more friendly in those days. And, we tried to hold this man to task, and the man's response was, I see no fish. And that was the end of it. So I'm wondering whether I see no injured party might have been worth a punt as well.
You asked for the injured part, like, you know, why have I not yet had a chance to meet my accuser?
Yeah.
Basically.
And I know there was some chat in the John McSee show about, once you were on the other side of the walls, as it were, about putting in an appeal within 21 days, you said, and I think not unreasonably, that you'd been pretty busy for a couple of weeks coming to terms with the situation. Do you think that next time, armed with that information and the stuff about the injured party and stuff, that you might try to do an appeal?
Oh, indeed. Well, there's an appeal going on at the minute. Like, that's coming up on the 10th of next month. So as yet, like, you know, it's still like on the borderline of how that's going to go, like, but you'll just have to wait for more updates on that.
Oh, I look forward to hearing how that goes, because we've had a bit of good news ourselves, and this is, I think, a really surprising story, and I'm not going to give any details of who or what, but basically some friends of ours found themselves at the blunt end of people like the Health and Safety Executive and the Department of Public Protection and all that kind of stuff. And their first response to this, I would have thought I would have gone along with Pat, which with denying title and trying to keep the courts out of it were probably two prime strategies. But what these individuals did was they straight away launched an appeal in the local magistrates' court, which I thought was, it really did look like a slippery slope to me. But the magistrates turned out to be pretty sympathetic to their cause and required these local government entities. Basically, what they said to them was, document and verify your claim. We want to know under what pretext you've got, you know, you're acting against these people. And a couple of weeks after that, the claim was withdrawn. And at least as far as we can tell, what threat there was is now no longer active, which I was stunned by. It actually gives me at least a little bit of faith in what was going on there. So hearing how your appeal goes would be really great, basically.
Well, that is quite interesting about what you said there about before any courts got involved in that situation, that they went straight down and lodged an appeal. And that's quite striking, really, because how often do we hear that, like, court is not really what's going on in the courtroom, that court happens long before you ever get near court at all. And I'm recalling here now, just at the minute, one case, this gentleman down in Cork, it's only there last year, and there was some matter came up, and he walked into the courts and he lodged an appeal, and I think he had, I think he also had a copy of the Constitution, perhaps, and he put that in straight away, just as long before the court case happened, and it went straight to appeal. It's in a situation where we're sort of invited to go to court, it may be a good idea to go straight to appeal at that point, you know. It's just a thought I'm having, you know.
Yes. Well, I was certainly surprised by the apparent effectiveness of this technique. And the other thing that struck me was it came to be known whilst all this was going on that this was the first time for 8 years that anybody had appealed against these particular organisations. So it's perhaps even more significant that that it actually worked. And it seems to have given my impression is there seems to have been, you know, perhaps even a little bit of glee amongst the magistrates that somebody was actually showing a bit of spunk, as it were.
Yeah, well, a bit of gumption, really. Yeah, because, you know, they see so much bull going on there in those courtrooms every day, like, you know, and a lot of the people are just, you know, you got solicitors, like, you know, they all have solicitors and they're all sort of like singing on the same mantra. So I can imagine, like, being a judge, you know, you get pretty sick listening to the whole routine of it all.
Yes, indeed. And yeah, if nothing else, there are human beings in there who are
new innovative approaches, like.
Yes. And they're under the same hammer as we are, one way or the other, as you so eloquently put it, you know, about the guys that were actually staffing the prison, that, you know, they're facing over their water charges and having to pay for water that's poisoned and not always available anyway, and trying to keep machines on the road and pay mortgages and pay ever-increasing levels of tax. And I can only imagine that some of the flesh and blood living souls that are actually operating in that system would themselves love to see it change.
Of course they would, yeah. Of course they would, because they also see, like, all the time, like, you know, innocent people going in and out there all the time, people who shouldn't really be in there. Like, the system is really not designed to be filled up, like, with people who just pay fine, this, that, and the other, you know, but you know, they're sizing they're there to do their job, like, you know, and when these people are stuck into the system, you know, they have no choice but to do their job, you know, it's their bread and butter in a sense, like, so, you know, they're just ordinary folk and trying to keep their heads above water just the same as everyone else, you know.
Yes, yeah. SD's put into the chat box, go to the clerk, Jimmy, and hand him a copy of the 1919 Constitution and tell him you want your case heard under it, which is an interesting one. Or you can try Carrot's recommendation, which is Carrot's is asking if anybody tried the old rolling their left trouser leg up, covering one eye. Worth a try.
Well, actually, what SD just said there is quite interesting, really, because recently I went into court there a few weeks ago just to have a chat with some of the ladies there that work behind the counter and says, asking the questions, is what do I need now to get things rolling, you know, and to get my case moving, and says, oh, it's already rolling here, the appeal is in. It says, no, but what do I have to do, you know, because that's their that's, in a sense, that's their documentation, like, you know. And I was kind of looking for something in along the lines of, say, forms of this, that, and the other of what you know, I might need, or things that I may put in, like. And he says, oh, we don't have forms, they said to me. And he says, so, you know, and that didn't sound quite right, you know. And so I kept plugging away and I kept chatting and talking with her. And eventually I got her to concede that, like, it may be possible for me to get an affidavit in and get attached to it, like, you know. So, you know, there are things I could do, which I'm just waiting on having a little meet up with a few people before I settle on the final stages of what I'm going to be doing, whether I'm just going to go in and sort of like plead insanity or you know, but you know, this I've still got another couple of weeks to go yet, so, like, got time.
Yeah. There's the
it was quite interesting though what you said. She could probably attach an affidavit onto the paperwork that's already there, so it's something I can look into.
Yes. Did you find those ladies on the front desk to be helpful?
Ah, they were quite sweet. One old dear, she hadn't a clue about anything, like, but there was another lady there. She was a lot more knowledgeable, and she seemed to be running the show there. And she knew exactly who I was and stuff like that before I even seen where she was. So she obviously seen me coming in or something, and she knew who I was.
I guess really it's the appeal where the rubber really hits the road, isn't it, in a sense, in that all of the... many of the techniques that we've been talking about for dealing with people on the side of the road and stuff are to do with holding them to their office and with keeping them within their own codes of conduct and all that sort of stuff. And I've gathered for some time that the place where remedy exists is after all of that has happened. And that if you stay peaceful and don't cause any trouble for yourself during those early stages, that gives you the chance to actually come out on top later, which I guess is what, I guess you're... you're in round two then, really?
Well, this would be round three. The court was on the side of the road. The administrative process, like, was quick, swift and quick and brutal. And I suppose appeal now, it is round three, I guess. Like, so, yeah. Just where it's at now, a minute.
Brilliant. Well, one of the things that I was wondering about when I heard you talking about the court case was just exactly what it was that the prosecution and the judge were kind of arguing about when you chose to take the piece of paper off them and sign it by colon. Were they arguing basically, do you think, about whether they were going to keep you in until you to go to court again?
Let's see. Let's see if I can recall now exactly what was the ins and outs of what was going on there. The judge was looking to put me into remand, like, you know, and the prosecution got a little bit panicky, and they didn't seem like they were wanted really to go there, you know. They were very, very reluctant, like, whatever was going on. So whatever was going on, like, was between the judge and the prosecution side, and they were very, very panicky about something, like, you know. And next thing, he went running up to the judge and they were having a big discussion. Just, I couldn't hear exactly what was going on, like, you know, but it was obviously something very, very interesting. So, I guess is, like, they weren't willing to accept liability, could that have been, maybe? I don't know.
Mm. Certainly, yeah, my impression was that that a cat had been introduced amongst the pigeons, and I was mystified as to how that might have happened, but I guess so many of the things you did probably did cause a bit of a stir, and maybe that's what resulted from it. But in the end, my understanding was that you're deciding to take control there and have that security away to sign it was what ensured that you actually got out for the interim, as it were, so that you got a bit of time to sort yourself out. Is that correct, do you think?
Yeah, that's correct. Because I needed on my way that day, because I had no preparations made or nothing for court cases that day. I didn't exactly leave home that morning, with the idea. I says, oh, well, I better sort this lot out because I'll be in court later on today. It wasn't like that. So I says, right, I could sort this out, right, and I can do without going in on remand now today. So why don't I just sign that little bit of stupid piece of paper there by colon? So, and that's what I said to him. I said, give me that piece of paper. And the judge got quite ruffled about that. He didn't like that. He said, that's a bond. I said, give me that piece of paper.
And you not only, I thought, that's certainly not something that would have occurred to me. I would have been mystified at that point, I think. But you, effectively bought yourself some time that you really needed, and you got to junk one of their bonds.
One of their bonds was actually junked, and the judge did actually recognize that fact.
I think that was inspired. I'd say that really overall, I know that it didn't work out too well, although it seems to me that I really love your willingness to take experience on the chin and just make the most out of it. I thought that was really admirable. But despite all of that, it seems to me that by and large, the experience in the court was relatively successful, in terms of experience and learning, hard though it was.
Indeed, yeah. It was tough, It was tough on the first day. Yeah, it was, they're not easy lessons, I have to say that.
Mm.
They're not ideal situations for ordinary folk to be in there, where you're being ganged up on, by three or four hidden hands, in a sense, because you don't know who's doing what. I do know now that you've got a prosecution, you've got a judge, and you've got the registrar, and they're all playing this game. It's three against one, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you get to keep your car? Your machine, or did they have that on
you? Oh, God, no. I don't know. That could still be sitting somewhere in some warehouse. It could still be there. I'd love to be able to try and see if I could get that back,
Yeah. And what about the things that were inside the machine? Do they all go as well?
Yeah, well, there was nothing inside the machine. I never travel on the road, really, with anything in the machine, just in case.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's difficult for all of us to manage that one, really. It has been a matter of some concern to me that's what probably happens under these circumstances, is that stuff is just purloined. So have you got any plans to try and get it back? Although it's a hard one, isn't it?
I just want to deal with this appeals first, If I could deal with this appeal successfully first, and then we'll work and seeing what I can do afterwards.
Yeah. What sort of preparations did you make at home for what you thought was going to happen next? Because you were, four weeks away from returning to court at that stage?
It was, yeah. Well, I was waiting for documents to be sent to me, apparently they were going to be sending stuff through the postal network, but they never do. It always ends up coming about 3 days before a court case. And it usually comes by a route of a couple of dudes in a fancy dress, so first day they arrived here, and I wasn't recognized or understanding them, they were there, banging at the door. He says, James, I have something here for you. He says, oh, hey, I don't recognize you, I don't understand you. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, he turned around on his heels and walked off and left, and they were about to pull off, and then I seen their machine stopped, and they were sitting there for about 5 or 10 minutes. So I couldn't see what was going on, but my guess was that they were there on the phone ringing the head office, and they were trying to figure out, what do we do? Like, you know, I guess, because, you know, they didn't get to deliver their piece of paper. So they drove off that day, and then I think the next day I had to go out for a while, and when I come back, apparently somebody had littered outside my door, and there was some sort of brown envelope there, which I left there. It's composting now at the minute at my back doorstep, probably somewhere. So what I probably could have done was sort of like made sure that piece of paper got back to where it come from, like, which I didn't do, I guess, you know. See, I do believe that there are solutions there with these pieces of paper, like, you know, because, but it's hard to know what to do when bits of paper come to you and they arrive like that with just a name on it and no return address. I mean, it doesn't come through the postal system, so you can't really return it to sender as such. I guess what you probably could do is maybe try and get it back into the police station. Maybe I don't know. Don't quote me on any, because it's just thoughts, ideas.
Yeah. No, that is an interesting conundrum, isn't it? I guess if there isn't a return to sender thing to do, I would have thought the best thing to do is do what you did with it. Laurie's put into the chat box. She's just RTS the summons. Find out how long your charge to the court lasts, because all charges are time served to a court. If they can't get you in by then, it's void. Keep all paperwork from court out of your hands, and after the time bar, they won't bother you, she says. So that's another interesting thing to think about. That's all news to me. But you did keep the paperwork out of your hands, didn't you?
Right. I did. I didn't touch it. I was petrified to touch it. So I'm just going to put this question there to Laurie. Does she think I could have just stuck that piece of paper into the post, even though it didn't arrive through the postal system?
Yeah, I have to see what she says about that. I guess,
we'll have to wait and see if she,
I thought that, I mean, aren't there some sort of restrictions that stuff that hasn't got a return to sender is not valid anyway, in some sense?
Sorry, could you repeat that, please?
Here we go. Paul's put, should have handed it into lost and found, he's put, and Laurie's put in, yes, Paul. Another way to show the court that court papers have not been served.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. And if Paul's then put in, if a stranger was to find it, he would have to drop it in lost and found. And Laurie's put, if papers never get served, they can't get to you.
Indeed.
Yeah.
For a paperwork lad to be served, would have to be signed for, would be my guess on it, like, you know, so, just a thought.
So, I mean, one of the things I was...
So it's a subject I have heard people talk about from time to time, about papers just getting dropped off and just left. And, you know, it's always one of those conundrums. Right, what do I do with that? Am I supposed to do something with that? Yeah. I suppose, what you could do, I suppose, is maybe possibly call the litter warden. I wonder, would the litter warden be able to get that through to where it's supposed to be going?
Another suggestion from Laurie is, she says, like Paul says, Jimmy, stick it into court as having been found in the street in a puddle. So I guess you could get one of your mates to return it to you, say, hey, I found this.
That is quite interesting, because I was listening to Robert there one evening. He was speaking with Pat, and they were trying to serve him with papers, you know, and I think it was suggested to him that he was just, the paper was just going to be left there, and he says, well, I'm not sure you should do that, you know, because if that might end up in a public bin somewhere and some member of the public might find it, and who's going to accept liability then? So, that's very, very interesting. Cool.
Yes. Yeah,
indeed. Cool. I'm going to remember that one.
Yes, it does sound like keeping the papers out of your hands is pretty much a good way to go. And one of the things I was thinking about in the time that you got between, you know, getting yourself out of one and into the next court case was that, as well as preparing at home, preparing for court would have been an option. But I guess that this is the best kind of preparation you could have been making. And I wonder how long that time bar is as well. I wonder how long you have to stay out of their way before they don't touch you anymore anyway.
Well, I'd imagine it works pretty much like, say, how notices work. You know, normally you get about 14 days to respond to a notice, and usually after about 30 days, I think you automatically go into default if a notice hasn't been responded. So I'd imagine 30 days would be the time stamp on that.
Yeah, yeah, and there's still interesting stuff turning up in the chat box here. Paul's put the blame is with you. If there's no return to sender, so if you can't demonstrate that you haven't laid hands on it, I guess. And Laurie's put, when the judge calls the court, he will he will ask if papers have been served. If they are in court hands, then they are not served. Excellent.
Excellent, yeah, yeah. Very, very important.
Obviously, the most important thing not to do there is to turn up and hand the papers in yourself, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, have a good friend who might find it in a puddle somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, you might find yourself in an even more complicated situation, eh? But I think...
Indeed, indeed.
I think all of that has been really useful to me, Jimmy. As I say, I was hoping to ask you all these questions anyway, and I think it's really good of you to come on and put yourself through the grill another time for People's Internet Radio, but I found it very educational, and there's been a lot of good stuff in the chat as well, and I, you know... 10 out of 10 to you. I just want to express my support and real love for you as well and for what you've done. And I think it sounds to me like under the circumstances you did really well, because it all came at you just really suddenly out of the cool light of an early morning, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, it's at that stage for me now where it's I've been working with it long enough now, and, you know, I'm not showing I'm making any progress at all. I may as well just give up and just seek the quieter life, you know, so, but I feel okay about how it went for me and all. So it's given me a little bit of encouragement to carry on, and I'm on the right path. Even though I may not be operating correctly, I still feel quite good about how everything has been going.
And as you pointed out, I think so rightly, that, that actually you can't be, it's got to be experience to learn, hasn't it? Because everything else is just hearsay.
Well, indeed, you know, because you could be studying and studying and studying for 5, 10 years, and then you could crumble on the first traffic stop because you've never had a chance to actually use it. And, you know, and that's more than likely the first outcome you'll have, is that you'll just totally crumble. You know, yeah. Because, you know, unless you're using this in your daily life, you know, it's not enough just, it's not enough just listening to pods and having it in the head. Just a lot of direct experience is required, I think, really, to make proper progress with it, you know.
And a lot of stuff is learned by a lot of other people as a result of your generosity in coming out and talking about it. I think it's absolutely brilliant. So I've got during the last half hour of the show, I'm going to have a bit of a surprise feature. We're going to be running an occasional feature. Meet one of Dr. Rock's posse, kitchen posse, and Van's agreed to come on and have a chat with us for the last half hour of the show, so we'll give you time to go and put your feet up and have a beer or whatever. But perhaps you want to, do you think we should have a quick rave about open source and the Creative Commons before you go, being as we're both Linux users? You've got a new setup, have you?
I do. I'm moving away from the one open source Lappy solution, which, while it's great, like it kind of lacks in kind of like a sound quality. So, I got gifted an desk there recently, so I'm going to make jolly good use of it.
Brilliant. Well, I really look forward to hearing you again. What do you think's the main advantage of using open source software against Mr. Microsoft's finest, or Max?
Oh, good God, hold on. I've got to write a book about that, of why it's better, because let's start with viruses for a start. And the plague and the bane of every Windows user is viruses. Viri, to be correct. And I've been using open source for donkey's years now, and I've never used a firewall. I've never used a virus scanner. I don't need it. I don't worry about stuff like that. That's be one of the chief main advantages of using an open source Linux system it's just amazing. Like you can actually take a sigh of relief, and you don't have to worry about opening documents anymore. You don't have to be worried about downloading stuff on the net. You don't have to worry about visiting websites because, you know what, they can't touch you.
Yeah, I must admit, I've never had a virus. I've been using Linux since 1997, I think, and I've never had a problem with any of that stuff. So that's got to be worth it, because I must admit, a lot of my Windows users friends have had trouble, especially with things like Skype going tits up on them, and then having actually quite a lot of difficulty fixing it as well.
Yeah, because some of those Windows programs, once they go in and they make changes to your registry, it's quite hard to track down those little changes that they make, and you might be able to remove a virus, but you know there could be a little hidden element somewhere in your registry, and it might reactivate it again. So Windows is just it's so finicky. It's just I just find it unusable, but you know. Matter of preference, I guess. So.
Yeah, one of the things I think is really good about the Linux software systems is how easy it is to get new software on there. It's, I find it generally just a simple command typed in, and the machine goes away, gets it, unpacks it, installs it, and it works first time. And that was never my experience with Windows.
No. To get software on Windows, you have to go all over the internet, whereas like with Linux, you've got like a repository of software, and it's like a master database, and all you got to do is just query the database, and it goes and installs the software, and everybody uses the database, so all software is held in one location, and it's very, very easy to redistribute, and it's just fantastic in that sense. Like, and the amount of various different kinds of software for doing all sorts of different types of jobs is just unreal. And if you really, really, really can't give up some of those Windows programs, we can even emulate them on our, you know, we can, because we use Wine emulation, so we can even still run our Windows software if we can't give it up or not ready to totally give it up just yet.
Yeah, and that works really well. I used to use the only Windows resident program I missed using was Adobe Photoshop, and I found that worked really well with that Wine, which actually stands for Wine is not an emulator, doesn't it? That's the other thing I like about Linux, is all these really strange self-referential names they give to things. And I think the other thing that I'd recommend about it is that Linux machines can communicate securely with each other, can't they? And that's quite easy to set up.
Oh, indeed. Like, you know, indeed. It's really, really easy. Of course, like, there's still a few bits, like, but you know, in general, like, it's fairly secure because, you know, those script kiddies out there, they're not interested in hacking operating systems which are difficult to hack, you know, so they'll just target the Windows machines because they're so easy. So, you know, you've got a certain amount of security, but I'm not happy though with the way the latest releases of Ubuntu are going. I think they're becoming sort of overbloated versions of Linux, trying to look like too much like Windows and trying to act too much like Windows. So, my rule of thumb is to stay away from those Ubuntu style operating systems where the software installers have too much. I don't like to give them too much control on my machine, you know. Because sometimes, you know, they make mistakes.
Yes, indeed. I tend to agree with you. And presumably, by running like Windows, they are going to end up in the long run opening themselves to some of the problems that Windows has. So, I've got a closing. I'll give you a closing question from Peaceful in the chat box, then, which is, what is the best version of Linux to use? And he's put Ubuntu in there. We can tell that that's not what you're going to go for. I mean, I'm thinking of in terms of a normal user, because I know you're quite advanced, but what would you recommend for us, you know, us users, not techies, if we weren't going to use Ubuntu, where do you think we should go?
I think you could probably go for, say, OpenCC or Fedora Core, probably. So some Red Hat equivalent, you know, for for the better security and stability, I go for Fedora or CC, I'd imagine, would be a choice. I use Slackware, and to me, that is the ultimate king, but, you know, it's there's a big learning curve before you get to using that. So go for SUSE. SUSE right. Or Fedora.
And I could run my IDJC broadcaster on that, could I? Or similar?
That's the beauty of it. Like, you know, all software should run, like, on any version of Linux, really. Like, at the end of the day, they're all sort of compatible. And even if, like, because basically, if you can't find a package, what you can do is you can grab the source code and you can compile and install from source code, and that'll be, when you do it that way, it's specifically compiled for your particular OS and machine. So, you know, just because there isn't a package doesn't mean you can't use the source code. So there's many roads to Rome.
Brilliant. Well, I reckon that just because of this buzz that I've been suffering from for recent weeks, we're probably going to end up upgrading the laptop at some point, and we can upgrade the operating system. That was the thing that really pissed me off when they locked you up, Jimmy, was they took away the doctor's support crew. That's insufferable. Because you're a very important man to keeping Dr. Rock on the road, I reckon. Freeman Jack's actually...
Well,
carry on, sorry.
No. Well, I'm just saying that I just want to give a little plug now for the GNU Linux group. Like, they're the ultimate support group and support network. And I'm just blown away by how far everybody's come on in that group. And, like, everybody able to help everybody else now. It's great. Like, you know, it all started out of just working on a broadcast solution. So we have a fantastic group there behind the scenes. So, if you do want to change over to Linux and you need some help, just give us a shout and, on the Skype, jimmy.hagen2, and, we'll pull you into the group, and we have a good network, don't we, Doc?
We certainly do. And that's another place where I see people from all sorts of networks basically meeting in one Skype chat room to talk about stuff that's useful to all of us. You've got radio presenters from all over the place. In fact, all sorts of people in now. It's great.
Indeed.
Yeah. So hopefully, yeah, like we say, there's loads and loads of advantages to using the open source software. It might give you a bit of a headache to start with, but those I find are reducing as time goes by. Freeman Jack's put in the operating systems, Mint, Fedora, Ubuntu Studio, I notice he's got, or just about any of the puppies, and those... The puppies are the ones that run on a little CD, aren't they? You don't even need to load them onto your computer.
Well, indeed, any Linux will let you run from CD, if you want to just try it out without making any changes to your operating system. Just download the ISO and run it off CD, and it should be fairly functional and give you an idea what it's like. So don't be scared of just trying it out. You don't have to make any changes to your system.
I'd also like to recommend on that note that if your Windows system stops operating and won't let you get at your files, sometimes you can get at them using one of these Linux puppies. I've done that a couple of times.
Indeed. They're a lifesaver. They're a lifesaver sometimes.
Yeah. Well, that's very good, Jimmy. Thank you very, very much for joining us and covering all of that. I really appreciate it. And you're always welcome on the show, mate. I'm sure we can find other things to talk about. So you come back any time you like. It'd be great to have you on.
Well, indeed, we could spend days talking about open source.
Well, perhaps we should talk about it a little bit and see if we can put together half an hour or so of talking about it. Because, again, to me, it's a genuine solution. I used to have so much trouble running this and that, and now I can do a lot more on this machine as a user of Linux than I could when I was using Windows. I needed to have specialist help much more often then, so... For no other reason than putting, you know, people's computer power in their own hands, I think it's worth talking about some more.
Indeed.
So that's really brilliant. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put on another couple of tunes and go and try and round up Van the Man from the kitchen and see if he's willing to come and chat for us a bit. And you can stand down, Jimmy, and go and have another cup of tea. And thank you very much, but not only for being on the show, but for all the support you've given me over all of these years. It's really much appreciated.
You're very, very welcome, brother. And, you know, we're a family here, aren't we?
Certainly are. Certainly are. Righto, I'll stick on that tune. I'll speak with you on the Skype in a moment. You're listening, of course, folks, to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com. And I've been speaking with Jimmy Hagan. And here come the Chemical Brothers.
There you go. That was The Beat and Mirror in the Bathroom. And before that, the Chemical Brothers and Hey Boy. Hey Girl. Well, I've got a surprise guest with me now, because I'm joined by the first of an occasional stream, hopefully, from the Kitchen Posse. You've already met Synchro. But tonight we're going to meet Van. Hi, Van.
Hi, Nick. Hey, Dr. Rock. Hi, everybody out there. Great show, isn't it?
Thank you very much. Yeah, you've been listening to it for a while now. You seem to find it pretty
interesting. Certainly last 18 months, I think. I do miss the occasional one, I know.
So, yeah.
Enjoying it.
And one of the reasons why I love to have you on the show is you've basically been non-compliant for as long as I can remember. When did you start being stroppy, Van?
I was stroppy and non-compliant when I was about 4, I think. first day at school, I was on the run. And there was these 16, 17-year-old guys chasing me down the road at 4 years of age. I've been non-compliant ever since.
So straight from school? You didn't want to go?
Well, I went into school the half term. I wet my pants and that was it. I was out of there. And my little suitcase and back home I was going.
And did that stay your response, or did you actually get any schooling?
Oh, no, my schooling was, I was schooled all over the world, so some of it was pretty rubbish, actually. Right. But it was great because schooling was, I lived in Libya for 2 years and it was non-schooling for 2 years. So my schooling was out in the sticks, looking for animals, looking for, and playing with chameleons. I had a chameleon tree. I used to collect all the chameleons, stick them up in the tree. I had 50-something tortoises by the time I left the place. My father was posted there right after the Second World War. Right. So I'm much older than everyone else out there, I think. I'm in my 70s, so, you know, I've done a lot, basically. Yeah.
Where else did you go in those early years?
Oh, I lived in Germany. I was at a military boarding school. That was interesting. My first memory of what I wanted to be when I was about 11 was to be a tramp. I thought that was a good job to have, being a tramp. My father wanted me to be a jockey. My cousin was a jockey.
And you have got a fairly small stature.
Oh, yes, I'm a bit bit broad around the trim nowadays, but yes.
So you kind of, you were subjected to education in these various countries as you went about. German boarding school sounds a bit fierce.
Yeah, well, that was a military boarding school. Yeah, I got into a lot of fights there. That was good. I learned to box in boarding school. I had to protect myself.
What was it that was getting you into fights?
Oh, mouth.
Really?
And I was also, I always stick up for other lads who were a bit weaker than me, and, you know, what was right and what was wrong was always important to me when I was younger.
Yeah.
And kids being bullied, I hated that, so I'd step in for them.
A lot of that at boarding school.
Yeah, and, you know, there were always kids a bit older than me as well, so I'd get locked in a room and have a fight with somebody 2 years older than me. Always come off all right.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose if you're determined.
Yeah. I was going, you know, you can't do that. I remember doing it with a lad when I first got to Germany. This was before boarding school, and it was 16 kids gathering up and with half English, half German lad, because he was half German. So I stepped in. Next thing I knew, I was facing 16 kids, and he wasn't. But that was the first time I remember girls going, ooh, swoon. it's real what you're doing.
Yeah. And so how did you get out of school? When did that happen, and where did you go?
I was living in Gibraltar, and it was a few English guys and an American guy, and we went to a Gibraltarian school run by Irish monks. Well, that wasn't very helpful, so we started disappearing up the rock and generally getting into mischief, chasing the apes and getting in all the military areas we weren't supposed to get into. And my parents must have realised this somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
So I was taken out of school, and my first job was at 14. What they didn't know, I was working for smugglers.
What were you smuggling?
I think they were smuggling tobacco, but there could have been gun run into Algeria at the time, because there was a war going on between the French and the Algerians. Yeah. I used to go to the bank every day with thousands of pounds. I worked for this job. They're supposed to be a packing station, packing tuna fish and apricots into tins. Once in 6 months, we packed.
Right.
And they had this fast motorboat, the next German kind of motorboat from the wartime. And they went out every night, and I went to the bank every day. That was a good job.
Yeah.
T-boy.
How long did you do that for?
About 6 months.
Yeah, and then what happened?
I then got a job in the dockyard. Then we came back to Britain.
Yeah. So was your dad in the army?
Yeah, he was a sergeant major. So that what he wanted me, I was like the last little lad in his regiment, really.
Yeah.
Short haircut, don't say a word, do what I tell you do.
It didn't seem to work very
well. No, it didn't work at all, actually. So stupidly, I joined the Royal Navy because that's all I knew. Is how do you get out of here?
Is that that's a lot? A lot of lads actually get out of home by joining the Navy.
Yeah, we're talking about mid-50s. This is a long time back.
And you must have seen, I guess you realised that it wasn't going to be too different from your dad's kind of lifestyle.
Well, yeah, I soon realised. So I got into a lot of trouble in the Navy.
Right, good.
So I was always in Navy prison, Navy DQs.
Yeah.
So I was three times in Navy DQs, once in the Army, DQs, and out.
And what's DQ? 6 months,
detention quarters.
Right.
Tough, mate, I tell you. It's bread and water.
Yeah.
You sleep on a hard wooden board with one blanket.
Are they
and your mirror is your piss pot. You have to shine, which is made of metal, to do your shaving.
Oh, so they try to keep you busy in there, then?
I was trying to fuck your head up and make you get back into the Navy as a good boy, but it didn't work with me.
So what sort of ships were you on?
First ship I was on was a cruiser. That's when we went round South America. I jumped ship in South America. I got caught the next day up in the mountains, me and my mate Fish. We had a job lined up and everything.
Right.
we were on the mountain at a village. It was on the ridge, about 10 miles out of Valparaiso, maybe a little bit less. But we saw our ship sail away, and there was five military ships, five naval ships, all disappearing. And that way was freedom, four beautiful young ladies, and a ranch where we could be the foreman.
And you got that?
Well, it's not foreman because they were British. Yeah. The British people had a massive ranch in the Andes.
And you got yourself set up with that within a day of getting off the ship.
Yeah, well, we went and saw them. We were invited out to what they used to call a banyan, which is like you go out and socialise with all the kind of expats.
Yeah.
Which me and me mate Fish did, and we liked this, Four beautiful daughters, none married, a mother with a father who was never there, and was on business somewhere. We thought this was the life. So the day the ship sailed, the night before the ship sailed, that was it. Up the mountain, whatever cash we had.
And they'd made it a fair way away before they realised you were missing.
Well, one of the ships went to anchor. We didn't know. We weren't the only ones who jumped ship in that port.
Right.
There's about another 16 that though jumped ship in that port.
So was that happening quite frequently then?
Well, occasionally, yeah. But that was the one port where it was a place to be, Chile.
Right.
At that time, Yeah.
So a lot of places to go once you got out the port.
Yeah, we got on the mountain, saw our ship sail. We were entertaining the locals in the local bar, come club, that night. Somebody went down and the police arrived the next day. And I was pumping away one of the old-fashioned kind of things. He was underneath his water spout. And we were both naked. And we were looking for civvy clothes. And this guy was looking, the guy who owned the place was going to get us some civvy clothes so we could get out of our uniforms.
Oh, right, yeah.
And there was it, me pumping away with my mate underneath it. And we were both naked, wanted a good shower because we were both got a bit pissed and entertaining the locals. And that the police arrived, two Sten guns, two pistols for them. Poke, poke, poke. Hands up in the air, out to the Black Maria. Down the kind of pass down to the docks at Valparaiso. And they were there, and on the back was like that. They were sat on the back of the running boards on the vehicles.
Yeah.
On the back, and the guns out that way.
You must have got out of there pretty quick.
Well, there was an officer for the Chilean Navy waiting for us. So that was it. Back to this destroyer, and we slept the two nights on the upper deck.
I see.
And then it was a breeches boy over to our boat, straight in front of the captain.
Yeah.
Straight into trouble.
And they locked you up again.
Well, we couldn't do much because we were sailing, so we were kind of, it's all what you call number nines in them days. It's all extra work, loss of rum ration. Didn't get your rum ration, that was a bad show, but your mates always looked after you anyway.
I see, so whilst the ship was actually running, none of these punishments, you worked and got punished.
You had to do extra work, you had to do all the dirty work, like cleaning out the heads, like the toilets, and doing and polishing the stuff. And when everyone else was all relaxed in the evening, you were doing all the dirty jobs.
And that lasted for the whole voyage, did it?
More or less. Lasted, I managed to get out, I jumped ship again, actually, in the next port, but I came back, and they didn't know that. I jumped ship and went and found an English merchant ship and spent the night over with them. One of the things you have to do when you're alongside, put the gash out. Also, you have to go over the side and paint it and silly things, So
were you thinking of jumping ship and not returning, or was that just...
That was just me pissed off with the Navy.
Yeah.
So I just went for the night and came back the next morning, but they hadn't missed me.
So what do you reckon was your most memorable thing that happened whilst you were in the Navy?
Ooh, I think being thrown out on the upper deck of an aircraft carrier in front of the whole crew, all lined up to see me being thrown out of the Navy.
That's how it all ended, is it?
Yeah. Then this was in Singapore. The ship had been fighting in Borneo against the Indonesians for the island of Borneo. And I was just pissed off with the Navy altogether. And I told a midshipman who's like a junior officer to fuck off. and that started all off. And then we had to go back, and I had to clean up all after these kind of Gurkhas and some other regiments. I can't remember what. They'd all been out there. We shipped in all these military people with all the kind of helicopters and everything. And then we shipped out the ones that had already been in there.
Yeah.
And when they left the ship, I was told to clean up their crap. And I said, I ain't cleaning up their crap. That's I've had enough of this. This is it. So I was just so gobby.
Yeah.
I was challenging everything that was decided. I should have never been in the Navy, but it was great. It was great fun.
And they didn't make you any less gobby. How long were you in there for?
Just under 6 years.
Right.
I spent probably about two... I was four times in prison. That probably amounted to a good year overall.
Yeah,
and then I was always in trouble on the ship, so I was always.
And then they had this kind of big ceremony, like the modern day equivalent of walking the plank.
You
had a whole aircraft full.
The whole aircraft carrier was brought to the upper deck. You know, what an aircraft carrier is all flat, isn't it? And that was it. I was a ceremoniously taking my hat off and dismissed out of the Navy. Oh, then they flew me back into an army prison in Shepton Mallet.
All right, so they didn't leave you in Singapore to carve a new sway.
No, I was in handcuffs all the way back then, Dave. You had to land, so we got to Bombay, and I was handcuffed into the kind of terminal. Then we got to, where do we get to after that? Somewhere in Turkey. The same thing, you know, into all the big, Istanbul it was. The same thing, handcuffed.
Yeah. All the way?
All the way, except on the aircraft. They took the handcuffs off, but they didn't want me to do a runner.
Right, you weren't going to do a runner from, not even you were going to do a runner from an aircraft.
No, I was happy to be a bit kicked out of the Navy. Yeah. I was enjoying it.
So how long were you in prison when you got back? How long was it before you hit Civvy Street?
About just under 3 months.
And that was for insubordination under fire.
It was a one-man mutiny, I think it was called.
One-man mutiny. I wonder, can it be a mutiny if there's only one man? Oh, very good.
When I was on another ship, I let my mate out. He was locked up in the wheelhouse on a really small ship I was on. Yeah. And I'd just come back from being in DQs, and they put me in charge of him on the mothership.
Yeah.
So I then kind of let him out of prison. We'd done a runner together when we got caught at the dockyard gate. So I was in, 10 minutes later, I was in next to him.
It's funny they should put you in charge of somebody else's in the nick,
stupid,
isn't
it? And he was my mate as well. Yeah.
Does that give us some idea of what the actual command structure was like there? Because it doesn't sound thoroughly intelligent.
It never was intelligent, and it's not intelligent from the top to the bottom.
The overall impression from me talking to you is that they don't learn from their mistakes either.
They certainly don't. Well, they're all up their own, aren't they, the officers?
Mm.
And you know, if you want to go up the ranks, you've got to be a bit like them.
Right.
It's all, you know, I've seen it all through my father. Mm.
It is a matter of compliance, isn't it? If you're compliant, you'll go far. If you're not compliant, you won't get anywhere.
I wasn't getting anywhere.
So it is kind of like a mirror of the outside world, really.
Yeah, well, you know, I came out, and next thing, what did I find? The things you want to find in life.
Yeah, so what did you do next, then? When did you come out?
In 1965. In 66, I went to Jersey.
Mm.
Found, started smoking some dope. I thought this was good. 67, I started hearing about LSD in London. I thought, what? What is that stuff? I want to know about that. So I hightailed it out of Jersey. I was being tracked by the police anyway. They were walking past fights going on in the street to follow me. I thought, this is enough of this. All my mates were busted. I was working on a little German ship that sailed in and out to Jersey. And I had a six-month winter job on. And when I came back one trip, all my mates were in prison.
What have they been done for?
It was all the smoke, it was all the dope. You know,
right.
They didn't want it in Jersey, so they busted about 50 people in one go.
So that was in the mid-60s?
Yeah, it was 67, that was, I think, early 67.
Yeah.
So
they were already trying to stick a nail in it then, because I was only six then, man.
Yeah, you're a young boy then, weren't you?
I feel like I was born just a bit too late for the 60s, but
I think I was probably 20-something then, 23 or something.
We get the impression that it was a little bit more permissive then than it is now, but evidently not in Jersey.
Oh, no, the Jersey police were all, police who had been, as I understand, been thrown out of the British police. So they recruited them into Jersey. So it was a nasty bit of work.
So they were already doing kind of refining of police forces even then.
Oh, I'd done 10 days, I think, was in prison because my landlady's son, because landlady who'd come out of the army, latched onto me, got himself really drunk, and knocked an old lady over in the street while I was trying to get him back to his mum. All my mates said, get fucking rid of him. And so I thought, and it was down to me to get rid of him. He was hightailing me. Yeah. I thought, that, you know, next thing the police had jumped on him, beating him with a truncheon. I said, yeah, just hang on. He gets off.
And you get nicked.
I get nicked.
Yeah.
Nicked. Yeah. And I wasn't doing anything.
Seems to have found these places magnetic.
They are, you know. So well, if you're an anarchist in your soul, you know, which I am, you know. I'm a Laddite anarchist, I've decided, because I don't like modernisation too much. I like to kind of sit back on it, really.
Yeah.
I'd be just as happy in the last century as this one.
Yeah.
And the century before.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've not been locked up since I know you. When did the persistent locking up start, and what was it that drew you onto the straight and narrow?
What drew me on the straight? I think I fell into it, really. I got done for dealing in London, so I went down for 18 months. And I thought, after I came out, I thought, let's hightail it to the sticks. Mm-hmm. And a mate of mine found this little place in Llandegly. And what I didn't know about that was, it was a funny story. We got there and the whole place was, the whole walls were decorated in Welsh language. And we did then discovered, this was the time Prince Charles was going to be, what was he going to be, made of something in Carnarvon Castle? Making him Prince of Wales, is it?
Investiture. That's what it was called, yeah.
And all these Welsh guys were up for killing him. Right. So the police were there. We think we're coming to the sticks where you're kind of way out in the wild, in the middle of nowhere. And these Welsh guys had just left, and we just moved in. And they'd been, police were watching them from the Pennybot Common. Every activity they were doing, because they were shit scared of what's going to happen, right, you know?
Yeah.
With them kind of threatening his life and everything.
Yeah.
But we knew nothing about it.
Nothing came of that, obviously, because he's still there.
He's still there, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, so there was a bit of an exodus of hippies from London to Mid-Wales.
Yeah, we were a doorway, the Grey.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, the guy I came with died of cancer many years ago, Al. And Nick disappeared. Mm. But we were the doorway. People would come and stay with us and, hey ho, find a little property, run down, cheap rent.
Yeah.
You know, semi derelict.
And
move in.
And so it was rented, was it? Or were you squatting?
Well,
or?
Then it was rented. Yeah, we were renting pennies.
Yeah.
It was 30 shillings a week.
Wow. For a farmhouse.
For a farmhouse. Lovely. Bit like Jan's. Wall like this. Fireplace like this. Mm. Open fireplace.
Plenty of space.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was good for a few years.
Yeah. Yeah, what did you do to keep the wolf from the door when you got here?
Well, you know what? We lived on £100 a year for 2 years. Three of us.
Really?
We had a massive garden. Grew all our own stuff. Went and brought sacks of rice in London for pennies and had a very simple life, simple diet, played a lot of drums, had a piano, made a hell of a racket, basically.
Yeah, that's the kind of life that, you know, we give our right arms for the opportunity to be able to do that now, and it's just not really possible, is it?
No, it's not possible anymore.
Because you have to spend, I mean, I don't know what the equivalent of £100 a year would be now. But you'd have to work really hard to earn it, wouldn't you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, we used to go hop picking, potato planting, potato picking. I'd climb a ladder to go and fix a farmer's roof because the farmer never got one step up a ladder. So that was me up his roof, sorting his roof out.
And were those farming jobs on local farms, you know, the potato picking?
Yeah, mostly,
stuff.
Did end up down in Pembroke for a short time doing the same thing.
So they were still growing a fair variety of veg instead of just sheep here in those days?
Well, the potatoes were always done down in Pembrokeshire. So we kind of copped a job down there. And the hop picking was over in Herefordshire.
Yeah.
You know, just get to know people, really, isn't it? Putting yourself about.
Yeah. And that was, I guess, just to earn a bit of cash to support your food growing. And
Grew a bit of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
In between the runner beans.
Yeah. And that lasted.
And the sunflower seeds.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. Yeah, and I know Syncro told me that she remembers seeing seeing your wedding in the local paper, and it got busted.
Yeah, we got busted. It wasn't the wedding day. It was a pre-party for all the alternative people. And it was a few hundred there, but we got busted, yeah. I was in prison for the night. It might have been the last time I was in, Nick. I'm not sure, actually.
Old habits die hard. Yeah. Laurie, the main admin's put a question, Nick. What age is the guest? Because I'm trying to figure out what the man's 100 pound is. So, did you say you were 70?
I'm 72, going on 73.
72, going on 73. There you go.
There you go, Laurie. Nick.
Laurie, you can go and go and Google that. Yes, main admin. She's a lady who looks after the site and keeps us all in line. Makes sure we don't swear and finds us.
Oh yeah,
don't.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. I've probably done that more than once already.
No, I think you've been very good actually. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So you eventually settled down into doing Whole Foods for people.
I certainly did. Well, it started off as a cooperative group thing, family thing, and it kind of centered around me and kind of because I wanted that diet. I was the first one, basically one of the first alternative people straight into this area.
Yeah.
So I kind of organised it and used to tell people, you've got to go to Pimmills Farm and pick up this, and you've got to go to London and go to Garvin's, go to Harmony Foods and go to Community Foods, John Law, my mate. And then I kind of left the area for a short time when I went to Pembroke, the building and that, and also went off to Yorkshire and became a hermit for 6 months in a derelict on top of the moors. And lived a life of a hermit on 27 quid, I think it was, for 6 months.
What was that like, living there? You look a bit like a hermit, actually. I didn't know you'd done that.
Yeah.
What was that like? See, were you living in a cave or a folly or something?
I was living in a derelict farmhouse, which had no doors, no windows, no... built over a cliff. So I had a kestrel on the one level with me and an owl on the other level in the milk parlour below.
Yeah.
But it was like, and I put a floor in, and I was going to go with a mate, and my mate backed off on the last day, so I became a hermit.
Right.
So it was all right. And after kind of 6 months, and winter was coming on, I thought, hang on, not sure I want to be a hermit in York. This was above Skipton.
Yeah.
Near Ilkley Moor. So
what made you go and do that? Because you obviously had quite a lot of productive shit going down. Presumably it was that just needed a break, did you?
Well, I think, yeah, I was always kind of up for an adventure, really. Yeah, me and Al were falling out a bit. So this is the guy who's died many years ago. We just couldn't see eye to eye. He was a Scottish Highlander.
Right.
Yeah. It was a fairly rigid kind of thought patterns of mine.
Yeah.
Where I'm very mutual in my thought patterns and try and work things around with your friends.
Yeah.
But he was kind of dogmatic. So... I'm sick of this Al for a while. Yeah. I think I'll cop out of it for a while. Well, I thought I was gone for good, actually. And another mate of mine said, well, I'm going up to Yorkshire. I found this little place. My girlfriend's going to uni in Leeds. You fancy it? I said, yeah, I'll give it a go. Because of the day we were going, he said, I'm not going now. I said, oh, fuck this, I'm going.
Sorry about that. I guess with a pair of people, there was a chance of starting another experimental sort of small farming project up there.
Well, I thought I'd bump into people up there, but nobody was kind of in my headspace, and I did kind of go out a couple of times and realise it was just a different world to Radnorshire.
Yeah.
So one day I got my pedal bike and cycled back home. knackered by the time I went over the top of the...
I guess one thing about living in a derelict farmhouse on your own is you're less likely to get locked up or get into a fight.
Well, I think in that time the farmer came up once. Somebody lost on the moor came up by once, and I put him in the right direction.
Yeah.
And two lads came looking for things, and I told them where the birds were, and I went up further up the moor, and I looked back, and they were running away. I realised they'd stolen my tools and a gold sovereign I had and a few other bits of money. And I think that was more or less when I decided to come back to Radnorshire.
Got on the bike. People are more reliable around here, aren't they?
They definitely are. Yeah. So I said to Al when we got back the grey, I said, I'm moving back in, mate. And he headed off to Scotland, and not long after that, when he came back, a few months later, he got the cancer and was dead within 6 weeks.
And was your budding business still running, or did you start again at that
point? Yeah, more or less, I started again, really, and I'd done it more like a little business, not making a lot of money. But then, a while after that, suddenly locals were coming looking for the shop. I thought, oh my God, this ain't for locals, this is me for me mates. So I thought, okay, I was getting married as well at the time. So I thought, decided, yeah, we'll move into town. I thought because, the next people up that track is going to be the health and safety, the weights and measures.
Yeah.
and all those kind of guys are going to be on your back, and, you know, and this whole thing was run on kitchen scales, and food was in kind of suitcases and Burko boilers, and, you know, and it was up in the attic, you know.
So you started to go straight then?
And that's the point, I started to go straight.
Yeah. Well, I reckon that's a really good place to leave it.
Okay.
I do, yeah.
I'll tell you what, Nick, we'll have another session at some point.
Yeah.
I'll tell you some more stories.
Oh, that's really good. Yeah, I enjoyed that. Thank you very much.
Thank
and
you.
It lightens the load a little bit after chatting with Jimmy about.
I like the man. He's a laid back guy and he has a lot to say, and good for him what he's up to, you know.
Yeah.
Challenging the system.
Yeah, indeed.
It's got to be challenged.
Yeah.
In your own different way.
Yeah.
I always feel like the system's like the bull and you're that matador.
Yeah.
You use it, but, you know, always make sure it glides past you somehow.
Yeah. Yes, it's getting a lot better at goring a few of us on the way
by. That is a trouble. You do get gored every now and again. Yeah, happened to me a few times, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
You've got to laugh, though.
Yeah, you have. Look, I'll just put on a couple of tunes. I gather that No Holds Barred are not necessarily around as far as we can tell, so I might hang around just a little bit and play some tunes, but here's a couple coming up, The Damned, New Rose, and then I'll come back and join you all before the end of the show. We're running over a little bit, because like I say, there doesn't seem to be anybody following on. So thanks very much, Van, I enjoyed that.
Cheers, Nick.
And like I say, we'll work out some more stories.
Well done, Dr. Rock, you're my man.
Well, like I say, the Kitchen Posse are one of my biggest supports, folks. It is just so brilliant to have a group of people in the kitchen offering physical support, hot food.
Yeah, good nosh.
Yeah, they don't always drink all of the wine before I finish the show either, so it's really,
damn it.
Really great. So here we go. Here's The Damned and New Rose. Thank you, Van. There you go. Swing from Yellow there. Well, I'd really like to thank Van for coming on as a surprise guest at the end there. It's really great to hear somebody who's so thoroughly non-compliant and still runs marvellous, really, local support. We've got a health food shop run by Van in the centre of our local town, and if we didn't have that, the next nearest health food shop would be a very, very long way indeed. And Jan, the lady who hosts us all here, and hosts the Kitchen Posse, and there's another mainstay, really, of the many invisible people that keep Dr. Rock on the air. She used to run an augmentary, a small health food shop as well, just up the road, so we did used to have two, now we've only got one, but we'd all be a bit stuffed without Van. And what an adventurous life he's led, eh? Spending so much of his time in Nick and not seeming to mind about it at all. So thanks very much to Van. Thanks a lot, of course, to Jimmy Hagen for all the info he gave us. Thanks also to all the people in the chat box who are putting in stuff for me to read out. It genuinely is still all a great education for me. I've still got to come across the first-hand experience, but I can't help feeling that one way or the other, it's coming to most of us. So thanks to all of those people. Thanks to all of you for listening, of course. It wouldn't be any fun at all if you weren't out there. It really is a pleasure sharing a chat box and a beautiful blue ball with all of you people. Thanks to People's Internet Radio for even being there and continuing. I haven't been able to have a rant recently in support of the various podcasts I've been listening to because the shows have been a bit busy, but I have been listening, and PIR continues to go from strength to strength. There's really a whole weeks of listening for me and now on my MP3 player, and I'm so grateful to have got away from the mainstream media and hearing some good sense being talked at last. So thanks to everybody, really. I shall be back again next week. At least part of the show, I've got Brian Forster booked to come and give us a bit of an update on those really strange elongated skulls that he's got in a museum over in Paracas. Find out what else he's been doing and find out hopefully the results of the DNA test he was running when we spoke to him, I think it's over 2 years ago now. So some of the show will be that. Rest of the show, not really very sure. At some stage, probably I am going to just play a bit of music. But maybe next week, maybe not. See you all there, hopefully. Here's some ZZ Top. Yeah.